Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, in studio with me tonight at the big table, one of the co-founders of the Annoyance Theater, Chicago's great underground comedy theater, and a man who has been involved with some of Chicago's greatest comedy performances. Mick Napier directed Second City revues like Citizen Gates and Paradigm Lost, which included an all-star lineup of now A-list talent, Tina Fey, Scott Adsit, Rachel Dratch, just to name a few. Throw in Stephen Colbert, Amy Sedaris, the Annoyance alums like Jeff Garlin, Andy Richter, Jill Soloway, and Jon Favreau, and younger talent now working on shows like SNL and in late-night TV like A.D. Bryant, Vanessa Bayer, and Connor O'Malley. And I've just named a sliver of the talent that Mick has helped develop, although he'll tell you he had nothing to do with it. Mick Napier, welcome to The Download.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You really don't. I mean, it's a sliver of the people you've worked with over the years. I mean, it's been decades of working with talent that now entertain the masses, but you don't take credit for their successes.
I don't really know. I mean, I do believe that I've had an influence here and there and a touchstone along the way, but I certainly am kind of anti-taking credit about people's, you know, successes and stuff.
We rarely see a class that you would teach in Chicago that says, maker of the stars. You know, you're not that kind of teacher that's like, I can get you on TV.
No, I'm really not that kind of teacher, and I don't revere teaching in that way. I look at it in a different way.
So let's talk about that. When did you come to Chicago?
I think in 1986.
So in 1986, when you came to Chicago, what was the comedy landscape like here? I mean, we know it now to be Second City, Annoyance, I.O., other theaters, and a very robust place for improv and sketch comedy. But what was it like in 1986?
Well, I think it was a very scaled-down training program at Second City, for sure. I think they had just started having around 5 levels, and right before I started, they had around 3 or 4, I believe. And then I.O. was only 5 years old. So I believe there were about 5 teams, and I was lucky enough to get on one of them. And we were all housed together at a place called Cross Currents, which doesn't exist, over at Belmont and Wilton, oddly enough, about a block from where the Annoyance Theater is right now. And that's where the Annoyance started in Cross Currents Cabaret, and that's where Sharna had one of her first permanent places with I.O. as well. But it was very, very small back then.
You know, I've talked to different people on the show. Greg Allen from the Neo-Futurist once talked about that Belmont and Clark area in the 80s, the late 80s. Ira Glass had, you know, had talked a lot on his shows, Wild Room and This American Life, about the epicenter of just counterculture that was happening in the 80s at Belmont and Clark.
Absolutely. You know, they had just tore down what was called the Punkin' Donuts, which was because all the punk kids and goth kids would hang out there. And a lot of runaway kids would just show up around Sheffield and Belmont. And we were running a show back then called Splatter Theater. It's a blood show that we run every year at Halloween now. So it drew a lot of weirdos and misfits and kind of freakish people. And it still has that quality about it, which I really like a lot. And now that we're at Belmont and Clark, I couldn't be happier. It really is the perfect place for us.
Talk about starting the Annoyance. What was the impetus to do that? Because it's one thing to get into improvisation or to try and move up and be at Second City, but it's another thing entirely to start your own theater company.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. And I didn't really know what I was doing at all, certainly business-wise and financially, all of that. But it started because we were having dinner at Leona's, some friends of mine, and we were wanting to do Splatter Theater. And it was September 10th, that we decided to open it on October 10th.
Sure.
And I kind of by default became the director of it. I never really studied directing or anything, but it was my idea, and I just kind of had that, I guess, that fortitude to want to get it done. So we opened Splatter Theater. Then we created another show called Coed Prison Sluts, which ran for 11 years here in Chicago, and we still run it on New Year's Eve every year. And then after we did that, we just decided we wanted to have a building. So we started searching for places, and we actually called the building the Annoyance, and our company was called Metroform, but now we're known as the Annoyance Theater.
Why did you choose that area? Because where you guys were at, you said Belmont and Wilton.
Yeah, that's where Metroform was. When we created the Annoyance, we were actually at, I believe, Broadway and
by the old Dominus.
Briar, yeah, somewhere in there. And there was an A-frame house on top of this building, and I lived there, and 60 people had keys to this place. And every morning there was someone, you know, new sleeping there. And it was crazy, and we did lots of stuff, and it had a deck, and it was insane and fun and all of that. And I was around 27, I think, when we did that. And like I said, I didn't know what I was doing. I got in a whole lot of financial trouble that lasted an entire decade.
Just for rent and buying things and getting in debt.
Property taxes and just a lot of stuff I didn't know about then that I know a lot more about now. after having, I guess, this is our sixth location now.
You know, I remember being in college. I guess it would have been like early 90s, like maybe 1990, 1991, going to see Annoyance Theater. And the vibe was one that you see a lot. You see it with, I mentioned the neo-futurists, same kind of thing, lines around the corner, people trying to get in because they wanted to see the counterculture, the alternative comedy, the underground comedy that was happening in Chicago on Broadway at that time.
Yeah.
When did you realize that The Annoyance was a hit?
Well, I think when co-ed prison slots started selling out in our first building, The Annoyance, another big indicator was the heyday of the Real Life Brady Bunch, which Jill Soloway put on The Annoyance stage, where she reproduced the Brady Bunch, merely reproduced it, not really parodied it, but we did it as best we could. I was Bobby. And looking back on that, I was quite reluctant to do it. We were going to do it for 2 weeks, and it ended up lasting for 2 years. It went to New York. It took Jane Lynch with it and Andy Richter. And it caused kind of a rift in our company at the time.
It was, why?
I think because half the people that were performing at The Annoyance then went to New York. And I had had creative issues with it, like as a younger director, thinking that it wasn't really like an artistic venture because it was merely reproducing a television show. But I was also in it, so I kept, you know, having this crisis of conscience with it.
And it was a hit, so it's hard because the audiences were going crazy for it.
Absolutely. And I remember, you know, I ironically remember accusing Jill Soloway of not really being creative with it or not being a creator. And the irony lies in now that she's innovating television with Transparent. Everything that she's doing is
creator of Transparent.
Insanely amazing. So, yeah, I regard her as one of the most creative people on the planet at this point.
Well, so. I mean, you're going to run into that. I mean, any creative people that you've worked with over the years, I mean, like I just mentioned in the lead, there's so many people have moved on to bigger and better things. For you, talk about that relationship because, yeah, you're butting heads with somebody on Off-Loop Theater. And then you see them changing the world on a stage with the Golden Globe going, I can only do this, you know.
Yeah, and it really is remarkable to see her do that and her sister. And the reason I know the Soloway sisters is from college. I had a group called Double Take, an improv group. And I actually formed an improv group before I had even performed or seen improvisation. I just wanted to do it so much. I had read Jeffrey Sweet's book, Something Wonderful Right Away, and it's a collection of interviews from Second City alumni, et cetera. And I became empowered to start a group and just held an audition, and Faith showed up at the audition. And that's how I got to know Faith, and then that's how I got to know Jill. And I'm very, very close to both of them now. And Faith writes on the show, and she's also a brilliant pianist. So you can just play by ear anything.
We're talking with Mick Napier here on The Download, of course, the co-founder of the Annoyance Theater, which is now at Belmont and Clark in the sixth location.
Yes, I think so.
Some of those, I have great memories of the building at Clark and Racine, Uptown.
Absolutely.
It feels like, you know, it's amazing to think it's been six different locations.
It is.
Let's continue the conversation. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation with Mick Napier here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest, Mick Napier.
Hello.
Longtime improviser, teacher, co-founder at the Annoyance Theater, which is at Belmont and Clark. You know, you went from being an improviser to being a director.
Yeah.
But the big thing that I think that people know you from is teaching. You've become sort of the master teacher of improvisation in Chicago, at least. And talk about that, because when did that transition happen for you from, like we just talked about, Real Life Brady Bunch and playing Bobby? When did you realize, you know what, I have a philosophy and I want to teach this philosophy?
I started teaching when I was at I.O. I decided I wanted to start teaching. And I got a clipboard with a piece of paper, blank lines on it. And I had people sign up if they wanted to be in this class. And it was $3 per person for my very first class. So I did get some people and taught my very first class, and that's what launched me into teaching. Teaching is so important to me. It's always been very important to me, and it's something that I'm very, very proud of with the Annoyance and the care that our teachers give there and how much we all are invested in wanting to empower people. And like I said before, I don't like to claim people as far as like the Annoyance, you know, because of our teaching, you're now famous, but I do like to think that we've had a healthy influence along the way.
What is your philosophy? Because, you know, there's always been two schools of thought in Chicago improv. There's always been and I always think of Bernie Sollins and Del Close, where you have this Bernie Sollins where improv and getting up on stage and for people listening in WGN, you know, essentially, quote unquote, making things up as they go with structure. Bernie always saw that to be a means to an end. That was practice almost, and the idea of putting together a show at Second City, where Del Close said, no, the art form is improvisation. With you and your philosophy, where do you stand on it?
I feel like that if human beings pay money to see other human beings improvise on a raised platform, it becomes a product, and therefore it's viable as its own art form. That doesn't mean it's going to be good, but it is, I think, an entertainment product. And I strive to make it a better entertainment product all the time. I have another book coming out about long-form improvisation, and its thesis is, to the improv community, let's treat long-form improvisation as an entertainment product as opposed to a process that an audience is forced to watch on stage.
Right. And far too often that does happen, where you see the process and you're like, I don't know why I'm here.
That's right. And a lot of audiences are not educated enough to know what the experience that they're getting ready to enjoy or not enjoy. And they're not given a roadmap for what they're seeing. And I think that we in the improv community kind of take that for granted. And it makes for some often boring improvisation in long form. So it's a goal of mine to do that. I created a show called Trigger Happy at the Annoyance. It's Wednesdays at 10. It's a long form. And in it, the cast share a secret language, like either physical moves or verbal moves that the audience isn't privy to. And when the other cast members hear or see those triggers, then it triggers a series of choreographed events, like in transitions or whatnot. So you're just watching, and all of a sudden everyone in the cast just falls to the floor, and you don't know why they did that. Or everyone starts talking together, and you don't know why they did that. So I'm always striving to bring more elegance and more choreography and more showmanship to long-form improvisation.
Well, you see a lot in your career. I mean, you've performed in a lot, you've directed a lot, but you've seen a lot of improv.
I've seen a lot of improv.
When you go see an improv show, your random show at I.O. or Annoyance, and you sit in the audience, what's your expectation? Are you looking for, you know, as someone who's been involved, are you looking for good technique? Are you looking for good process? Or are you open enough to be an audience member? It's like, I just want to be entertained, regardless of how you get there.
I think I'm really good at being an audience member if I have an expectation that the improvisation's going to be good. If I'm seeing Messing with a Friend, if I'm seeing TJ and Dave, then I have that expectation. I don't know if you heard about a show called Stolen Houses.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a group of very, very good people.
Yeah.
Yeah, Stephanie Weir, Bob Dassey, Scott Atsit.
TJ and Dave were in here talking
about
that.
TJ and Dave, yeah. And they took over a set of an existing play. And boy, that was probably the most brilliant improvisation I've ever seen in my life. And it was thoroughly enjoyable. My expectation, though, at random when I see improv is not that high. It's like, okay, here we go. I have a joke about improvisation. It's always different, and it's always the same. Because it does have a series of kind of familiar patterns and behaviors that people get into and they get trapped into. And it kind of is out of fear, and it prohibits them from making real daring choices and fun choices.
And that's part of improv, I think, for anyone who's listening who's not familiar or has seen improv before. Choices, that's a big part of the art form.
It is.
It's the choices that the improvisers on stage make.
Absolutely. And making courageous choices is very hard to do sometimes. And applying specificity to what you're improvising is also something that seems so simple but is very difficult to get to sometimes. Improvisation, it gets laughs for different reasons, and it's usually based in point of view and relationship or character. And it's not because you constructed a joke. So it's kind of a different way of looking at
comedy. Do people – I got to ask, do improvisers seek you out? Do they say, you know what, I am having a hard time figuring out my choices on stage, or I feel like I'm stayed, and I'm looking for someone who is going to help me figure that out so I can go to the next level. Is that when they go and find a McNapier?
I think so. I certainly get asked a lot of questions.
You're not
about
doing
that.
Intro. You're not doing, you know, hey, it's intro. Here's your lawyer, and you're not
right.
Doing that kind of like intro to improv. No.
No, I'm not like getting dates for people and things like that. I hope I'm not. You know, I might be accidentally doing that. I think that people do seek not only me but the Annoyance, because we have a reputation of being very individual with our assessments of people. My very first class of every class is to hear everyone's name and where they're from. And I've become good at memorizing names. And as a result of not being good at it for so long, I really wanted to become good at it. And the first thing I have them do is improvise for a half hour or so, and then I give every single person a set of individual notes about what I'm seeing and about challenges they might have in the next, you know, few weeks or whatever. So that's something that I'm very well known for, I think, and something I enjoy doing.
Absolutely. And yeah. I know I've had a lot of friends, and I was just reading some stuff about you, about the way that you do give notes. no BS comes up a lot.
Okay.
the idea that, you know, you're real with the person and you tell them direct, honest feedback. And sometimes, I mean, it's not to hurt them, but it's not all. There are some teachers that I've had in my life who've tried to sugarcoat that.
Yeah.
But in your case, you're like, no, here's what you did. This is what you did wrong. This is what you need to work on.
Yeah. I try to be very direct. I try to be very honest. And I really want to be kind. And I really want to be affirming as well without BS. And it's a fine line in there sometimes.
How do people, I mean, you've had so many students over the years. How do people react to that?
I think people react pretty well. I think so. I think that they feel I think they feel relief that they were getting some honest feedback and that it provides something proactive for them to work on. So, because I just won't tell someone something wrong about them without telling them a remedy or something to work on.
Mick Napier in studio with me right now, the longtime improviser, teacher, director. You can see numerous shows at the Annoyance Theater Monday through Sunday.
Yep.
Let's take a quick break for the news, and we come back more with Mick Napier here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the big table rolls on, and my guest tonight, Mick Napier, longtime improviser, director, Paradigm Lost at Second City, is still considered one of the, we had Scott Adsit in here not too long ago, one of the best shows Second City's ever produced. And it continues to be. I mean, it continues, like when you read the books or anyone puts together a definitive history of Second City, people point to that show. Mick, why do they point to that show?
Well, I tell you, it was a great cast, and I was certainly felt strong enough and ready to make a difference with the structure of sketch comedy. And I think that it all came together in a really perfect way. It was Scott Adsit's third show. I think it was Tina Fey's second show. So it was just a really perfect harmony. It was also a strange experience for me because I was doing what I called a journal at the time, and now it would be called a blog. And I was able to do a journal on the internet at a time when no one in the cast was on the internet. So they weren't going to be.
This was 1996, maybe 1997,
something like that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, not many people were on the internet. They had email or whatever.
So you were journaling the show as it was happening.
Absolutely, and that journal now is part of. I just had a second edition of my first book, Improvise, and that journal is included in there.
Wow,
it's really fun, and I remember just having a scotch every night and. You know,
did you know when you were putting that show together, and that show had Tina Fey, it had Scott Adsit, Rachel Dratch, Kevin Dorff, Jim Zulevic,
yeah.
Did you know at that time was there a lot of fear involved? Because you were changing, I mean, Pinata Full of Bees kind of changed it already, but you were changing the sort of formula at Second City.
Yeah, I was, and providing a lot of exposed transitions and choreographing a lot of things that way. I didn't really know at the time, but I really was proud of it. It was also strange because it was being taped by HMS Media. They were doing a documentary, which became Second to None, which is a documentary of that entire process. So it was strangely being measured as we were doing it. Hmm. But it was great. You never know exactly who you're working with. I have students who ask me, like, what is it like working with, Steve Colbert? And I will say, it is exactly like working with you right now. And it is,
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Let's talk about the process, because you wrote about this. And it was interesting about the idea that Second City in Chicago is part of an ecosystem in Chicago improv. So you have I.O., you have Annoyance, you have other independent theaters, you have a lot of improv in the back of bars, you have sketch comedy festivals.
Yep.
But for Second City, the idea being that this is the main draw. This is the one that brings in the big audiences. If you go to a show on a Friday or Saturday, Sunday night, anytime really, the house is packed. It's hard to get tickets. But there's always been this thing where inside the community they go, well, that's the safe comedy. Second City does a different broad. They're generic. It's not as cool. It's comedy, and I'm anti-comedy.
Yeah.
And you kind of write about the idea of why people say that and why that's there, and it's not necessarily about the performances, because some of the greatest performers and the comedy and the writers, it's really about the audience.
Yeah, it really is about the audience. Second City is one of the best places to work as a director, because the policy is that those stages are held sacred as far as the artists are creating in there. So it's rather producer free. Even the owner, Andrew Alexander, will be very hands-off about a process. He might give a note here or two, but they're very, very hands-off. So it really is the director and the performers, and what you're seeing on stage is the voice of the actor, which I hold sacred as the director. So it's a very protected environment, and The reason that it sometimes gets that reputation is because of its audience base over the years. It has a 60%, 50, 60% tourist-based audience. So those are people from coming from all around. So if you do really weird subversive comedy and you get absolutely no laughs at all, and you do it again, and you do it again, and you get no laughs
still no
every
laughs,
time,
right.
And it puts a big hole in the show that you have to recover from because there's no energy. Do you keep doing that 8 times a week for 8 months in the run of the show? You don't. You try to get away with as much as you can and still do your job, which is to entertain the audience you have at hand.
And that's really what it's about. I mean,
it
for
is.
Sketch comedians, for stand-ups, for anybody, you have to recognize the audience that's in front of you. And a big part of Second City and sketch comedy and sketch comedians is being able to adjust.
Absolutely. I always say, you know, that, like, you want to invite them to the party and make the audience feel safe and then push it as much as you can. And it never makes me feel good if I have, even with the annoyance, for sure, if audiences leave, some people might like, yeah, we drove them out of here. And for me, it's like, oh, we drove them out of here. And that's a drag. I'd rather have them enjoy the experience. If we wanted to have them leave, then just have everyone come on stage, all the actors, and just say, get the F out of here, over and over and over until everyone leaves. And are you happy? I mean, I don't think that's a great time.
I think there is that push and pull for artists versus commerce, or even, you know, we talked about a little bit, process and product. The concept of they're doing something that people can't understand, or I'm way ahead of you, you can't understand it, so you're leaving, that's your problem, not mine.
Yeah, I think that's a drag. I think that it's much more noble and takes a lot more energy, and it's much more courageous to create a context for an audience that they can enjoy, even if it's strange and weird and really outside of the box.
One of the great things about, I mean, I was reading your Tumblr, you put out tips.
Yeah.
But it wasn't necessarily tips like, here's what you do on stage. And that's what you hear a lot from improvisers, especially teachers, instructors. Here's yes and the different rules that are in improv. But this was about how to be a robust or rounded out improviser in terms of off stage.
Yeah.
So little things like, you're not always going to work with people you'd like.
That's
Which
true.
I think is a huge thing. People like get bent out of shape. I've seen a lot of actors like, I really don't like this person, and this is really going to affect me. But as you're saying, when you get to TV land, when you get to LA, New York, there are going to be a lot of people that you just don't like.
So many people that you don't like. And if you're at this scale, people do complain about people in their shows and stuff. I really hate this person. But if you were on a network television show, would you go to the producer and say, I don't really like my co-actor in the scene? Can we fire them? I guess some people do, but
yeah, right.
Yeah, but you know.
But the idea being that it's a lot about the business side of it. It's getting people prepared for their next move, that whether it be to LA or New York or here in Chicago. But a lot of what you do is preparing them that it's not just about how funny you are on a stage. It's about how your character plays off stage.
I think so. People become very seduced. They'll be on a team for 2 years, 3 years, then they find out it's like 7 years and they haven't created a headshot or haven't visited an agent, and then their career is going away. But they get all of this kind of reinforcement at the tavern because they're on this team, or they're in 4 shows a night. You know?
Or they're funny, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
All right. That.
Yeah.
So it takes a special kind of sense to get that you're also your own little business and everything. And this comes from failing at it miserably all my life, so...
I don't know if you have failed at it. I mean, because through all that, you know, learning, it seems like you've learned along the way. And not just about what's creative, what's improv, what's property tax,
yeah,
and all those kind of things. For you to move throughout this career in Chicago improv, you have learned and you have adapted. And that's what makes you, Mick Napier, at the top of the improv community right now, that people want to work with you. I mean, I was talking to Pete before that a lot of these improvisers come through can read about Del Close.
Yeah.
Or they can read about Marty DeMott. Or they can read about some of the teachers that have really made an impact on the people that we see. But they can actually take classes from Mick Napier. You have become this generation's Del Close.
That's, I don't know. I shirk at that. But I appreciate it at the same time. I try to make myself fairly accessible. Like, I'm at the Annoyance doing card tricks at night and stuff like that. And people will visit me. Some people are scared to visit me, which I welcome anyone to say hello. Business-wise, though, I have to shout out to my fiance, Jennifer Estlund, because there's no way that the Annoyance would exist if she hadn't kind of resurrected the business of it and everything. So that's helpful. I'm the artistic muse, I suppose.
You're the one with the card tricks at the bar.
I'm the one with the card tricks at the bar. Getting a laugh here and there. I do kind of hate the phrase guru and all of that.
Yeah.
And I, I, I always try to avoid that because I kind of fancy myself as a little more humble than that. I have a very working class attitude about my life. My dad owned a construction company. I grew up in construction. I think that's sometimes why I'm so intolerant of the pretentiousness and delicateness of actors around me all the time.
And maybe that's why you stand out. I mean, maybe that's why people want to be around you, because there is that delicateness that rises to the top with a lot of instructors, a lot of professors, yeah. You know, where they're like, let me tell you about when I was on the stage.
Yeah.
And that's not your MO.
No, it is not at all.
Mick Napier in studio with me here on the download. We'll come back and let's talk about Chicago.
Okay.
Because you've done projects on the coast. You know, you go to L.A. to work on stuff. Exit 57, which we didn't even talk about, which is one of the greatest shows with Amy Sedaris and Stephen Colbert and Paul Dinello. But let's talk about why you're here, why you stayed here, and what you think of this town when we come back.
Okay.
Mick Napier, stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest, Mick Napier, longtime improviser, instructor, teacher, not a guru. We're not going to say guru. And director here in town. You know, you said you came here in 1986, and for the most part, you've stayed here. I mean, for some projects, you've moved out to different cities to work on, Exit 57 in New York City, and projects, you know, all the time have you out in L.A.
Yep.
But what is it about Chicago that kept you here?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, I do have a working class attitude. I think I could live in New York. We have another smaller theater in Brooklyn, like a 40-seat theater. So we've been traveling back and forth there a lot. And I love New York. But Chicago is kind of a working class town. And I learned how to live here and learned how to thrive here and not completely be poor or homeless. So, yeah. I just like it.
When it comes to the work, when it comes to the improv community, I mean, you talked about the modest beginnings of the Second City workshops in 1986, and I remember doing the conservatory in 1995, 1996.
Yep.
You think about it now.
It's crazy.
I mean, it's crazy. Thousands and thousands of kids pouring in here to learn the art of improvisation and work with you. So Chicago's changed when it comes to the improv community as well.
It has, and internationally it's different. UCB has gone, you know, just gone crazy, and their facility in L.A. is huge. I.O. is huge. Second City's doubling its training center. So it really is crazy right now, and there's no sign of it going backwards. I think thousands of people really want to get into the work for various reasons. So it's thriving right now, for sure.
Is that a good thing for the Chicago improv scene, that more and more people are coming here?
I think it's okay. It's kind of sad because there's probably an expectation among a lot of people that they're going to, you know, zip through here and get on SNL or whatever. And as the volume goes up, the numbers of talented people, you know, that percentage kind of goes down. So that becomes a little sad sometimes. But I think that there's certainly enough of a community to support the number of people that would want to be here.
Do you, as a director and as a teacher, do you see more of that when the numbers go up? Do you see, is it harder to develop talent or to spot talent because there's so many people coming through the door?
I think that it's not that hard because I only have a finite people in my class. So those are the people I see. I think I also have an advantage because I get to see really young talent at the Annoyance. And then also, since I run the Second City auditions, I can see a lot of people there. So that's just kind of a magnet for some of the better people in town.
When you say run the Second City auditions,
yeah,
it's something you've done for years.
Yeah, like over 20 years.
What is that? That's essentially when people want to get on the touring company.
Yeah.
They go on stage at Second City in front of you and a select few to essentially improvise a scene.
That's right. Well, they'll improvise some very short scenes and then improvise a longer scene. And then, yeah, I think that's just about it. And then hopefully if they'll get called back. And then if they get called back, then they have to create a one-minute piece and do some scenes, some archive scenes for Second City, and improvise again. Then if they're lucky, they might get placed as an understudy in a touring company.
For you, being at the center of that, I mean, when I remember doing it, it was you were the one who talked.
Uh-huh.
You're the one who said, hey, RK, here's what we're going to do. What does that mean for you? I mean, to know that all these people are outside getting ready, you know, this is the moment where they think they may, you know, make that step in their career, and they come in and you're at the helm.
Yeah, I can tell you that I remember when I first taught at Second City, taught my first class there, and I was 24 years old. And I remember getting off the Sedgwick L, and I remember sitting on a stoop, and I remember starting to cry because I was so scared. I was so nervous. And then I got my, you know, self together, and I walked in and taught that class, which incidentally, Stephen Colbert was in that class, which was, I didn't realize till later. I remember the first time I auditioned. I was terrified and shaking, hyperventilating, and couldn't eat or anything. So every time I run that audition, I remember that. I remember those times when I was just out of my mind scared, because it is one of the scariest things in the world to walk in that room. Mm-hmm. There's 10 to 15 producers in there. You don't know them. You're on stage. You're Second City with all its reputation. And you're forced to be funny, or you want to be. So I really try to treat people with kindness and make them feel comfortable and try to make them laugh a little bit or whatever. And it's very important to me to do that.
You mentioned that Second City reputation. For you, you're a big part of that. I mean, the idea of over the years, the shows that you've directed, but also you've been in that building, you do the auditions. And you think of Second City's place in Chicago as you know, people know Second City, it's synonymous with Chicago. What does it mean to you to be synonymous with Chicago?
It's quite okay. It really is. It makes me feel good. It makes me feel good to have that affiliation. And it also makes me feel good to have that relationship with Second City. When Second City caught on fire, I got on my bike and flew down there, because I was amazed at how emotional I was about that and what it meant to me. And I think Chicago means more to me now than it ever has. Jennifer and I did an inordinate amount of bike riding this summer, and it was so beautiful to see Chicago from different angles, from the south side, from the west side, and did the 606 like 20 times. I don't know. I really like Chicago. Very accessible, and there's, you know, so enough to do for sure.
Now, I mean, you're in a business where tomorrow they could say, Mick, we want you to be the new director of the new show 3.5 Men that's going to be on CBS. I know.
Yeah.
You're big into that? I mean, is that the work can take you elsewhere?
Yeah.
And it can put you in a different place. You can always come back, but it may take you somewhere else. Are you okay with that?
I am okay with that. I was bizarrely became the executive producer of an NBC sketch pilot last year. So I spent a lot of time in LA. I was very sad when it didn't get picked up in a way, because it was funny, because I lost $250,000, because that's what I would have earned if it would have got picked up.
Right, yeah.
So that was kind of fun. But I was also relieved to get back to Chicago. And when I was in New York for 3 years, I was relieved to get back to Chicago as well. I don't know. I always like it here, and I'm really happy the annoyance is here.
Mick Napier, author, improviser, director, performer. The new book is out this month.
I think so, yeah,
yep.
Later this month.
Also, the reissue's out. I mean, you've got so many things. You can see the shows, Trigger Happy's on Wednesday nights at 10 o'clock. There's so many things happening. Mick, thanks for coming down.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for being here, and congrats on being synonymous with Chicago.
Thank you.